Email todayradio@rte.ie.
One of your texts to 51551 says, this is Rory in Dublin 8. He says, I would love to see the August bank holiday Monday renamed John Hume Day along the lines of Martin Luther King Day in January in the USA. It could be a day dedicated to community development, social work and civil and human rights issues, and above all else, peace. May John Hume rest in a well-deserved peace. As I said, that comes from Rory in Dublin 8, and you can keep your text coming to 51551. Now, there are over 18.2 million COVID-19 cases worldwide, with some countries who thought they were over the worst now experiencing a resurgence. To get the latest on the situation around the world and what is likely to happen next, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director of the World Health Organization's Emergency Programme. And Dr. Ryan, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, and just let me say that it's a very sad day on the island of Ireland with the death of John Hume, but it's a sad day for all of us in the United Nations system. John fought for social justice and respect for diversity all over the world. He was a man of principled compromise, not compromised principles, and he's a hero to many outside the island.
Right, and thank you for that. I wanted to talk to you about, firstly, about the worldwide resurgence of the virus, as I said, and I'm wondering, are you worried about the situation around the world at the moment? Particularly, we see the situation in Australia and the state of Victoria.
Yeah, the situation, yeah, as you've seen, the number of cases, we're having about 250,000 cases a day around the world, and this is heavily focused in a number of hotspots around the world, and the high numbers are really coming from the Americas, from India, from Iran, and a few other places. In Australia, what we're seeing is a flare-up of the virus, mainly centered in Victoria and specifically in Melbourne, and the authorities there are taking no chances. They're really trying to shut this virus down before it spreads to communities in other parts of Australia. And the measures may seem extreme, but Australia has been very successful in containing the virus so far. They've only had 221 deaths and 18,000 cases, and their case fatality is about 1%. So they have a lot to protect, and they're really trying to protect against a flare-up of the virus that will, you know, generate a major epidemic.
Mm. And obviously Australia is currently in its winter season, so the winter flu is an issue as well. I'm just wondering how worried we should be here in Ireland or in the Western Hemisphere about the upcoming winter months and combining that with COVID-19.
Yeah, it's a very good and interesting question, because we would expect to see influenza flare-up as it does in the winter in Ireland and in Europe in general. And certainly having co-circulation of the two viruses is number one, it's going to put an extra burden on health systems. It's going to create difficulties and challenges in diagnosis and dividing between the patients. The positive news is that we're not seeing a massive influenza season in the Southern Hemisphere. And frankly, a lot of the measures that have been put in place, physical distancing, wearing masks, and hand washing, are probably driving down the rates of influenza in the Southern Hemisphere. So, you know, the same measures that stop COVID-19 have an impact on stopping influenza. So what we're hoping is that these measures that are being put in place and are being kept in place and sustained by governments will result in a much lower influenza season. But we can't predict that. We just don't know what coronavirus will do in the winter, and we don't know exactly what impact our current measures will have on influenza in the Northern Hemisphere.
And do you think health systems are fully prepared for that here?
Well, health systems have had to show a great deal of resilience over the last number of months. It's a credit to the frontline health workers and to the hospitals, what they've managed to do to scale up their response. So hospitals around the world, and I would say particularly in Ireland, have been through the wars. They've had to deal with a huge punch to the system, and they've done that very well. Yes, the addition of extra influenza cases may put more pressure on the system, but I have confidence that the health system in Ireland has stood up to the test well, and will continue to do so. But we need to drive the number of infections down. The way to take the pressure off the health system is for all of us to do what we need to do to reduce our risk of infection and reduce our risk of infecting others. If we do that, if we control transmission at the community level, that's how to take pressure off the hospital system. Yes, make more beds, train more doctors and nurses, provide more PPE, but that's after the fact. That's really putting pressure on a bleeding wound. We need to stop the wounds.
Yeah, and I suppose on that, the problem being that we're seeing in different countries, indeed even here in the last couple of days, we've seen an increase in the virus, and we're seeing it across Europe as well in different countries, recent spikes in cases. Do you think that countries and people are becoming fatigued with the restrictions, and how do you combat that?
Well, it's very understandable. Everyone is fatigued, and nobody expected this 7 months ago. No one expected our lives would have changed so much. People want to get back to their work. They want to get back to their social lives. That's entirely understandable. But we have to stay the course. We know what drives transmission of this virus, and we know the consequences of not stopping that transmission. What we need to do is get to a point where we can pick up the flare-ups and the small outbreaks quickly, and they will happen. They are, in some senses, they are almost inevitable. The real test is how quickly do we react, and can we, in some way, snuff out those small clusters before they affect the whole community. And that's the problem. We do not want to get back to full-blown community transmission where everyone has to stay at home, where people have to reduce contact to nearly nil. We can sustain a new normal if we all do what we need to do. Mm. But we're going to have to be very, very careful over the coming months in advance of the delivery of a vaccine that may help us to finally stamp this out.
Yeah, and can you talk to me about that, the delivery of a vaccine, and when the WHO expects that to happen, and what difference that will make in terms of day-to-day life?
Well, there's about I think we have about 139 candidates that are currently in some form of clinical evaluation. We have 26 of those candidates in full-blown trials, either phase one, two or three trials, and of those we have six that are in phase three trials. And phase three trials are essentially population level trials. That's when the vaccine gets tested in ordinary people and we get to see whether the vaccine actually protects against infection in the real world. So this is a tremendous effort across the world to have six vaccines in phase three, 7 months into a virus that we didn't even know what it was 7 months ago is an incredible achievement. But we have to be patient, because we have to make sure those vaccines are safe and that they're effective. And what we mean by effective is what proportion of people who get the vaccine are protected by that vaccine. And we really need to get a vaccine that's highly effective, because using a poorly effective vaccine won't stop transmission. So we have to really work hard to evaluate these vaccines and pick the best ones and use them appropriately. If we do that, yes, we can use vaccine to drive down transmission. We can certainly use vaccine to reduce mortality. But it may not be the silver bullet. It may not be the complete answer. And we will have to sustain the public health measures. And may I say that in Ireland now, we have to work, and you have to work, and we have to work globally with the tools we have. And the tools we have are individual and community action. They're strong public health surveillance. We have to pick up clusters quickly. We have to turn around testing quickly. We have to isolate and treat cases. We have to quarantine contacts. And we all have to, in some senses, pitch in. And if John Hume is looking down upon us, that's what he would want. Mm. He would want us to pitch in and do what we need to do, each one individually, to contribute to fighting and beating this virus.
Can you give us any idea, though, Mike, for how long, or is there any idea as to how long we will have to live like this? Even if we do get a vaccine, as you're saying, we may still have to live with some of the new normal that we've become a little bit used to.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of everyone. We need every country around the world to apply pressure to the virus. The difficulty is, in countries like Ireland that have been working hard to suppress the virus, if other countries aren't suppressing the virus, then the likelihood is the virus comes back and reestablishes itself. It's like weeds in a garden. If you only weed one part of the garden, then you're going to be back in trouble a few weeks later. You know, we've all got to, every garden needs to be weeded, and we need to get this virus out of the system everywhere, or else we constantly risk slipping back. But we're not talking about slipping back into full lockdowns. Ireland is in a position, with the careful work that's been done, to chart a path out of this. It already is. People are moving around. People are resuming daily lives. We just have to be careful. We have to use our brains. We have to know what is risky, and we have to avoid what is risky. That doesn't mean we have to continue to shut down our lives. But if we allow community transmission to return, if we are complacent, then we will be back in that situation. Okay. And that is what we need to avoid.
And can I ask you then about travel and international travel, given, as you say, some countries are treating this very differently to other countries. One of the things that we're being told the Irish government is looking at potentially doing is having pre-testing, whereby somebody who might be considering coming to Ireland will get a test done about 3 days before they'd board a flight. And if they're positive for COVID-19, they wouldn't be allowed to come here. Has anything like that been proven to work? Are other countries doing that? Is that something that the WHO would approve of?
Many countries are implementing similar procedures of pre-testing and then screening before travel, and then obviously reducing risk on in travel and then screening again on arrival. And yes, certainly pre-testing can help, but it's not a panacea. Because if I'm tested today and I'm negative, I may have been exposed 3 days ago, I'm incubating the virus, and on day three I'm negative, but on day three before I travel I'm negative, day two before I travel I'm positive. So yes, it will take out some positive cases out of the travel process, but it won't remove all. And again, this is about risk reduction. We need to pick every point and reduce the risks. Certainly certification again of pre-travel testing, you have to rely on the certification from another authority, and there are all kinds of issues about what certificate you rely on, who can certify the person that's tested. So yes, it is certainly an idea that can be on the table for countries, but it has to be taken as part of a broad multifaceted risk management or risk reduction strategy. It's labor intensive. It adds cost to people who are traveling. It can discourage people from traveling, but it can have benefits. So if it's seen as part of a broad based strategy and we understand that it doesn't reduce risk to zero, it certainly does not, then it can be used as part of that. But each country has to make those decisions for themselves.
Sure. And when you say a broad-based strategy, does the WHO have a position on what that should be when it comes to international travel? A lot of talk, for example, about mandatory quarantines or things like that on arrival here. Is there a position from the WHO as to how to reduce the risk to zero, or is that even possible?
Well, it really depends on what the risk is in the country people are coming from. If someone was flying directly to Ireland from New Zealand, so we don't have planes that can do that, but let's imagine that was the case, then the risk of that person bringing disease into the country is almost zero. But if someone was coming in from another country with high rates of community transmission, then the risks are obviously higher. The reality is that the country cannot entirely shut down economically or socially. We're connected. Irish people are connected all over the world for so many different reasons. The trick is managing those risks. And when people travel to Ireland, depending, I don't know, the various lists that Ireland has of risk for categories of countries, I think Ireland has a restricted movement order for people who come to the country, and they have to restrict their movement so they reduce their risk of transmitting to others. And I think that's prudent. It's impossible to shut borders entirely on an island, but what you need to do is manage the risks associated with that travel. And in that sense, there has to be a managed compromise between what is the health of the nation and the economic and social well-being of the nation.
Can I ask you then about, again, I don't need to ask you specifically about Ireland because I know you're looking at the international situation, but like many governments around the world, the Irish government is considering later today on whether we can proceed to phase four of reopening the country. That would see the pubs reopening. And one of the things that we've heard from our health minister, Stephen Donnelly, is that there is international evidence that pubs can spread disease, or this particular disease, the COVID-19. Can you tell us a bit more about the what you've seen in terms of international evidence and the role of pubs in terms of spreading COVID-19?
Well, I wouldn't say that the pubs are spreading the disease. It's the context, not the the specific environment. But certainly poorly ventilated, crowded places where people may reduce their social distancing, let down their guard. And, pubs in Ireland are highly social enterprises and are often very crowded. So from that perspective, it should be seen in the context of can you manage transmission in that environment. It also has to be taken into account that Ireland is currently only zero, I think about 0.2%, only 200,000 people at the moment tested are actually positive. So Ireland is doing quite a bit of testing compared to the number of people who are positive. And it may be that where there is localized community transmission, localized measures may have to be taken. But again, it is a balance, and it is dependent on people's behavior and how people adapt. Certainly restaurants have reopened in Ireland and others, and it will be important to look at the success of that. Have people complied? Has that been managed in a way that has not increased risk? But crowded gatherings, parties, things where particularly younger people gather in large numbers and where social and physical distance is reduced, we've seen that in other countries. It can spark epidemics, and it has to be managed. So again, the Irish government has a very difficult decision to make. It must be taken in context with the background epidemiology. Ireland has a very low incidence. It's worked very hard to get there. Obviously, no more than in Australia, Ireland will have to make a balanced decision between the risk of the epidemic spiking and the need to get back to work and social life. And it's not an easy decision. And quite frankly, there are no correct answers. Every day the data changes, and the government must remain flexible and be given the flexibility to manage this in a prudent way.
And you mentioned localised lockdowns. I'm not sure if that's exactly the word that you used, but is that something that you could see working then, where you might have all of society open, including the pubs and restaurants and whatever else might not be open now, in most areas, but maybe where the virus is at a higher rate not?
Yes, and that to an extent depends on the mobility between areas. But certainly you can use a much more localised strategy by county, by province, whatever it is in the Irish context. But to do that, you need very localised data and you need localised response capacity. If you're going to say there's no need to leave the building because there's one room burning, then you have to absolutely trust that the fire service can put out the fire in that one room. Mm. And therefore, localised rapid response, the ability to turn around testing quickly, the ability to investigate clusters quickly and reassure everybody else, yes, we're taking the localized measures and maybe even localized measures that increase the level of physical distance, reduce crowding. And you've seen that in Australia. The state of Victoria has one level stage 3. Melbourne has a stage 4 lockdown, and the rest of the country is in other stages. So now Australia is a very big country. Ireland is a small country and people move about. So again, there's a limit to how much you can localise measures, and it does to an extent then depend on how people move between risk areas.
Okay. Can I ask you then about younger people, Mike, because the schools are due to be reopened here in a couple of weeks' time. I suppose, firstly, because there was a lot of talk throughout the virus about young people's role, both in spreading it and also in whether or not they were likely to get infected. What is the current situation that we know about, or the latest evidence, I suppose, about how likely young people are to pass it on?
Well, certainly younger people are not as likely to get as sick, and that's clear. But we don't know what the long-term effects are of even mild or moderate disease. In terms of passing it on, most of the data would suggest that those younger people over the age of 10 or 12, those teenagers, participate in transmission just as efficiently as older adults. Those under 10, it would appear that they don't contribute to transmission quite as much. And there is that difference between what we call children and teenagers or younger adults. But the fact remains, whatever part they play, younger people's behaviour, as we've seen in many countries, is greatly either contributing to or contributing to the disease getting better or contributing to things getting worse. And our younger people need to take that on board. Everybody has a responsibility in this response. You have a responsibility to protect yourself and a responsibility to protect others, particularly those who are vulnerable to more severe disease, older people, people with underlying conditions. So it's really important to act smart, get smart, and do the things that need to be done. We all, again, we're back to what your first question about people being exhausted by this. Absolutely, it's tough, but we have to sustain the effort because we do not know what the long-term impacts are of moderate disease in younger people. And we've seen deaths in younger people, and we've also seen how, in many cases of moderate disease, people who weren't even put in didn't even need to go to hospital, long-term heart effects of this disease. It's really, we cannot make assumptions about what the long-term effects are. But protect yourself, protect others, make the right decisions and try to sustain this effort. I know it's tough, it's very difficult, it's very easy to say it, it's very hard to do it, but we need to make that effort. And younger people are part of the solution, I would say, are not part of the problem, not certainly in Ireland, but they need to continue to be part of the solution.
All right, Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director of the World Health Organization's Emergency Programme. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Today with Sarah McInerney on RTE Radio 1.